Let's hear some of that movie chat. Credits roll by and I tip my hat. Credits roll by, wanna know more right away. Let's have some of that movie chat. Credits roll by, tell me who did that. Life in the credits is where I wanna play.
Welcome to Life in the Credits. This is the show where we learn about entertainment by chatting with people who work in the industry. I'm Susan.
And I'm Ben. And here we're discussing the film A League of Their Own.
And joining us today is our special guest, Madeline Waitozo. So welcome, Madeline.
Hey, Madeline.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. So we're very excited to talk to you today. Can you get us started by saying a little bit about what you do in the entertainment world?
Sure. So I am the founder and CEO of Juniper Media. We are a social impact storytelling company for brands. What that means is we're all journalists. We all came from a journalistic background. I started the company 5 years ago. And so the kind of watered down version is that we help companies that we personally feel like we align with to create social impact through media and policy.
Very cool.
Can you tell us about any of the specific projects you've worked on?
Yeah, gosh, we've been really lucky that we've worked with some pretty amazing brands from the beginning. So our longest client is Indeed.com, the job site and hiring platform. And I would say probably one of my favorite projects with them is they have a real commitment to fair chance hiring. So helping formerly incarcerated people come out of prison and have a second chance or a fair chance to get hired. And they've invested quite a bit into creating a place for employers can examine their own bias and their own discrimination and make changes from the inside. So a project we did last year, I spent, I think, 2 to 3 months just interviewing people who'd come out of prison. And some of them had been in for 20 years. Some of them had been in as minors. Many had been in more than once. And the whole desire behind that was how can we tell these stories from their perspective and help humanize a really serious and systematic problem across America. That's definitely one of the projects we've worked on that I love. We also, one of our first projects was in partnership with a production company called Even Odd. They hired us to go to Dearborn, Michigan and interview Lyft drivers who were Muslim. And it was during what is known as the Muslim ban in America. And really the whole desire there was to focus on what makes people from that community valuable in the gig economy, because they were dealing with so much discrimination and so many policies, right, that discriminate unfairly. And so, I got to go spend a week in Dearborn, Michigan and take a lot of lifts and a lot of conversations. And it's just a really amazing thing to apply my journalistic background to a different kind of storytelling. And something I really believe in it. I really think that social change is happening from some of these companies that actually really care about that impact.
Yeah, I had no idea Indeed did that much kind of behind the scenes to level out the playing field. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're focusing on in a couple of different areas, but last year that was a big one that we did. Yeah. I ended up putting more effort into it. They have a big conference every September called Future Works, and it's where thousands of hiring managers come together. And last year, what we did was I think in total, I interviewed probably 30 to 40 people who had spent a majority of their lives or at least a few years in prison for a variety. I mean, everything from a marijuana charge to murder. Right. And we took the most powerful and resonant stories, the top 8. We flew to Kansas City and Austin, and we filmed these sit-down interviews with them and then took their professional portrait. And the final product was at that conference, we blew up their portraits to 10 feet tall on these big canvases. And there was a QR code and kind of on their chest. It said, I am not my, and then there was a blank, I am not my record, or I am not my, criminal past. And the QR code that was in place of that word, you'd scan and you'd open up and they'd be basically talking to you one-on-one, and they'd talk about who they are. Are they a parent? What skills did they learn in prison? Or, even what are some of the things they learned in prison that aren't I learned HVAC or I learned typing. And it was just really moving and amazing to be able to impact people and also just give dignity to people that don't get enough dignity, that there's this really common experience that they serve their time in the years that they're there, but they're really serving it the rest of their life.
Yeah.
So that's just been a real, real privilege and a gift to be able to do that work.
Totally. That's fascinating. So how does the process work for putting together this kind of content? So once you find a partner, obviously they're looking to make something. How do you and your company fit into that relationship?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really depends on the client. So some people come in and say, we really just care about this issue and we have this much money. And then we get to kind of go from creative direction and researching all the way like soup to nuts. Others come in with an idea and they say, we want to do this and we want it done this way. And we help with the research and casting. I would say what we're probably most known for is the research and casting element. How do we bring real people to these stories? How do we find the real people? And also, how do we tell their stories with tact and dignity, which is really difficult when you're talking about marketing campaigns?
Right. Yeah.
You know, people don't want to feel exploited. They don't want to feel used. They don't want to feel like they're, you know, like it's not about them. And I think because we are all journalists at Juniper, we really do care first about the people and about the story, and second about, you know, how to fit it into a company's mission or values. And we're also sensitive to that. Like we can be picky with our clients for that reason, but we love obviously when they come in earlier, because that gives us more creative freedom and able to kind of build from the beginning, but you know, we can kind of work with whatever they want.
So how would casting something like the Indeed campaign or one of your other ones work? How do you seek out those people and their stories?
So it's not a very glamorous answer, but some of the best stories we've ever found have been on Craigslist.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. That, how does that work?
Yeah, and it depends on the demographic, right?
Yeah, right.
If you think about, I mean, you have to kind of also know where to look and why you would look there. So for example, Craigslist, that's a place where people who are getting, they're not on traditional websites, they don't have a lot of connections, they're looking for gig work,
right?
You know, they're looking for day labor, because that's all that a lot of these people really feel like they can get. Also, we have relationships with different organizations. So organizations that are supporting people coming out of the system, justice impacted folks. So I'd say that's a big part of it too. We did a commercial a few years ago that was focused on an LGBTQ Nigerian refugee who came here and got a job through Indeed, and that job impacted his life. And now he's positively impacting other people like him through this job. And that one we have found through a refugee related organization that we had a relationship with from our journalism days. So it is a very be resourceful. We don't like have any like casting website. I don't even know what they are, you know, but like we're not any like extras casting.
Right.
We're not looking, because we're also not looking for actors, really.
Right.
We don't want someone, and we've found people before that when we interviewed them, they felt like they were too acting and we couldn't use them for that reason. So
interesting. Once you find someone to interview or to do a story about, how do you approach that process? Because so many of the segment producers we've talked to for different news stories or late night or whatever it is, they do a ton of pre-planning. But for stories like this, is that possible? Or do you guys just sort of capture content and then make the story in post? How does that work?
Yeah, it's more of the latter in the sense that you don't know who you're going to get or the quality of who they are on camera. We do something specific called story banking, which is something we created. And it's basically a big database of folks who we get their photo, we get their summary. We have a link to their initial interview via Zoom. We have their contact. And then we also have notes in there for the client of like, these people, the story is amazing. They're not great on camera. Use them for social posts or use them for editorial. And I think that actually makes us unique compared to a lot of like typical quote creative agencies. Like they get paid an X amount of money for three stories. We're going to deliver your stories, but we're also going to give you the 12 that weren't quite the right match and hope that you use them, because these are real people we spent time with and we want you to, you know, have the opportunity in the future to use them. So I do think it is, for the most part, and I think it does depend on the ask. It depends on who shows up. And that's like the magic of it. It's just like, who's going to be in the chair, you know, and what's their story. And sometimes they've surprised us. And sometimes we've followed stories over time that have evolved. And one of my favorite stories is this gentleman that we interviewed. He had been in prison for 26 years and he had initially looked for jobs when he got released. But because of the nature of his sentence, he was just getting rejected left and right. And so he stopped applying and he ended up going on disability. And when he was in prison, he had converted to Sikhism and learned a lot about yoga and meditation and actually taught yoga and meditation inside prison. So the only choice he had, he felt, was just to go back and volunteer inside the same prison where he'd been released from and collect his ability. And that's what he was doing for 6 years.
Wow.
And then we did this campaign with him. And he said it was the first time that anyone had ever been interested in who he was and listening to his story from a human perspective. And he got to see his photo. We give them copies of the portraits that we take, which were beautiful. He said that after doing that and seeing the final product, it like inspired him and kind of something became alive in him. And he got back. He actually got on Indeed, not to plug Indeed, but he did get back on Indeed. And he got a job. He got a job as a peer support specialist for people who were coming out of being unhoused and in recovery from addiction. Wow. And he now works there. And we did a follow up with him. We went and shadowed him with a camera for 2 days and did like a little vignette about just the power that having exposure and having someone listen to your story, yeah, having someone say, I'm interested in knowing who you are now, not what happened 26 years ago. It changed his life. Mm-hmm. His name's Atma. I'm like Atma for president. Like he's just such an inspiring person. Yeah. I want people like him to have, you know, a platform and have a microphone. Yes. So anything we can do to empower those kinds of folks, you know, I'm all for it.
Yeah. I think that really speaks to what you said about your company being made up of journalists and people who really want to value the people they're interviewing. You're taking these stories and you're like, okay, this doesn't work on camera, but we know this story needs to be told. Here's all the ways you could use it, where it gets out there and people hear it. And it's to the, like shows the strength of the story without making the person telling it feel like uncomfortable or like they're not in their element. So I think that's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. And I think also when you're doing traditional casting, it's like, is this actor the match or not? Throw them away if not, you know? And it's I get that actors are used to the rejection and it's like part of whatever, but I don't want people to feel that way. And I think, you know, my professional background, I was a associate producer for Vice. And then before that with MSNBC. And, you know, that's really important. And something that I learned is like, this is about the story. Of course, it's about the outlet too. And, but the integrity, right? Mm-hmm. And I also think that when we're talking about commercials and marketing, people want to trust and feel like the products or the services that they're buying more now than ever have integrity and have trust. And I think it's one of the biggest challenges, honestly, as a business owner in this specific, very niche industry is like making sure that the companies and clients we have are walking their walk and aren't washing anything. They're not greenwashing. They're not rainbow washing. They're not, you know, which I feel like we've been really good and diligent at discovering thus far. But yeah, you want to make sure that people feel valued and seen. Yeah. And that comes through in the campaigns. I think they really do.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Cool. That's great.
Backing up for just a minute, can you kind of tell us your career path and how you got to where you are today with Juniper Media?
Sure. Yeah, it's a winding one. I'll tell you that.
It's okay.
So I was born and raised in Northern California. I had a couple really challenging experiences early in life. My father passed away the summer between high school and college. And so I went to my first 2 years of undergrad at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, which is a strange place to go for someone who's from like a hippy dippy Northern California town. Yeah. And so that was a trip. And then also, I just think I didn't have any real skills to deal with grief. Mm-hmm. And my coping was to, you know, I was in a sorority and partying and no one else around me for the most part could relate to any of my personal life circumstances. Wow. And it all kind of caught up with me like sophomore, junior year. I think my mental health suffered. And so I ended up transferring schools middle of my junior year of college, took a semester off and finished at UC Santa Cruz, which is actually where my father had taught before I was born. So that kind of felt special. And it was near where I was from and, you know, up in the woods and their mascot's the banana slug, if that tells you anything about the constitution of that college. So, but I think I dealt a lot with depression and just honestly feeling like, you know, watching your parent, my dad died from cancer, watching your parent die. He and I were very close at a young age. It just really, I think, made me take life super seriously and feel like the magnitude and mortality of everything. And I think I felt separate from other people my age for that reason. So I was going to go to law school and I thought human rights was really important. And very quick tangent, my senior year, I took this personal development intensive weekend where you're like basically locked in a room with 100 people and you have to like, you know, confront your stuff and they give you assignments. And it was very transformative. It was really intense. I'm like glad that I did it. But one of the things that I like kind of had faced in that was that I was being inauthentic. It wasn't actually authentic of me to go to law school. I was doing it because it felt safe, because it felt like I knew what I was doing, because it looked good to my parents' generation. And what I really wanted to do was make a difference in the media. There was this exercise they did. I don't know if it was like a meditation or something, but I had this flashback of being like 7 years old in front of my parents' TV back when it just like the remote had two buttons, right? And it was like up or down. And there was like an ad council ad. And it, well, you guys might remember it. It was like the, this is your brain. This is your brain on drugs, the egg in the pan.
Of course,
and I remember being like blown away by that at seven. I was like, that is so cool. Like, yeah, I'm going to to do drugs. Obviously that didn't last, but like, you know, and, but also just like being so excited that like you could influence behavior.
Yeah.
And I was seven. I didn't really have the words for it, but anyway, I was in this intense weekend and I had that flashback and I was like, I that's what I want to do. I don't know what I wanted. I want to do something like that. So I quit law school applications. I moved to LA in 2007 and got a job as a PA on a reality show. Well, it was the writer's strike. It was the 2007 writer's strike.
Right.
Like, I think like a week after I moved there.
Yeah.
So I was working on reality shows, game shows, the revival of American Gladiators with Hulk Hogan came out about that time. So I was a PA on that show. And
amazing.
Yeah. And I just kind of like from that, I was 23. Then I think between there and 28, I kind of ping ponged back and forth between that and doing like NGO. I moved to DC from there and that weekend course I took, like, it just made me like be willing to take more risks and like fail and strike out bigger. And so I went to DC, I got a job as a PR like assistant for a political firm. I worked for the World Bank for a little bit, got that job through a friend. I was like the assistant, had no economic background, felt like I did not fit in at all. I'd still joke that the best part about that job was that the World Bank in DC has a really incredible cafeteria because it's a that like there's all these different like Nepalese food or like, you know, it's just like, you know, and so that was neat. If that tells you anything about how deep I was in that organization, but really bad breakup. I guess I was 25 and I literally put on Facebook like, hey, I'm looking for a new life. Who's like, I need to leave DC. You know, the kind of breakup where you're like, you can't even be in the same city anymore because everything reminds you of that. It was like one of those where I was like, I need to leave my life and recreate. Yeah. And so I was trying to move here to New York and that was impossibly expensive. And I didn't, you know, and all that. And a friend of mine said, I know someone in Ghana who runs like a nonprofit and they're looking for a program manager to like come out for, I could choose how long I wanted to go for and like what the role was. And I was like, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Didn't know anything. I didn't have to look up Ghana on a map. I didn't know anything about Africa. And I came and it was amazing. It changed my life. Just got to like get over myself in all of the ways I needed to, you know, get over my privilege in a lot of ways, get over like just my suffering about woe is me, whatever was going on in my life. And I stayed there in Ghana for 5 months. And then I got a job at USAID in Benin, two countries over. There's a whole story in there about that I thought I was getting kidnapped at the border at one point, but it was just like a miscommunication because I didn't speak French.
Yeah.
Like, dying. And I loved it though. And then I came here for grad school. I came to New York for grad school, not thinking, wasn't thinking I was going to do media again, and did a master's in international affairs and a focus in human rights and media. So I kind of had that human rights element along the way. And I got an internship at MSNBC while I was in grad school. That turned into my first job. And that was a night shift, which definitely do not recommend to anyone who wants to maintain any remnant of their sanity or mental well-being. And that was on the early Today show. So it was the show that came on at 4 a.m. and 7 a.m. So my shift was like 11 to 7. I was an AP. My boss on that show, the executive producer, had like 3 or 4 kids and he would like go from work to their hockey games and stuff. And I'm like, I was like single with, I had a cat. That was like my biggest responsibility. And I was like already failing at life, you know? Oh
my God.
But working in the news excited me. And I loved being a part of breaking news because we were the first to report.
Right.
There were also politics, I think, at that time. I remember wanting to pitch stuff that was like really important and it was like not the right audience. Like, oh, that's too real for 4 a.m. or 7 a.m. Yeah. Like that's like puff it up. Because we got the alerts on our screen for things. No one else was reporting yet. We were the first and I was like, let's do this, you know, and it would be really frustrating for me to they'd say, no, that's like too early for that. Or we need to like lighten up and then seeing CNN cover it an hour later. So, And so from there, I survived 5 months on the night shift before I like had a full like, this is not worth it. Yeah. And I from there went to Vice and that was 2016 when it was like just in the beginning of its like booming phase. I mean, they were always cool, obviously.
Yeah.
But they went from like 600 people, I think, when I started to, I think, 15 a year later.
Wow.
1,500 people.
Yeah.
And that was a dream and a nightmare at the same time. And it was incredible. Such talented people, so much freedom. It was great. Yeah. And then after a while, I got the sense that I wasn't gonna be making any more money there, which was not a lot.
Yeah.
And I had grad school debt and I was 32. And yeah, so I tried to freelance. And while I was freelancing, this guy I went to high school with, he had a production company in San Francisco, Evenaud. And he asked if I would do this like story finding for a Google thing. And I was good at it because it was like journalism, but easier, but better pay. And felt like I wasn't sacrificing my moral compass. And that's kind of how it started. So it truly is that cliche expression of like building the plane as you're flying it.
Right.
But it's worked out so far. And we're really grateful for the success that we've encountered and continue as we're growing, which is awesome. So yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously you're very passionate about a lot of social issues. How do you stay impartial when you're working on, you know, a campaign or a story or whatever that content is? Obviously, you guys have a point of view, but how do you make sure that it doesn't cross over into the biased territory?
I don't know that that's fully possible. I mean, I'm sure there's companies that wouldn't want to work with us. And we wouldn't work with them. We value something like on LGBTQ. How do you stay impartial? It's not a partial subject.
Right.
I would say the biggest challenge and what I think is so important and what I wish there was more of in this country is the ability to keep having conversations.
Yeah.
I think that's what needs to be happening more than anything. But to be able to bring people to the table and have discussions, I think is a lost art and is dying more and more every day and concerns me greatly for the election coming up. And I wish that we could all be willing to have our opinions and our beliefs and not become them so that we are so separated.
Yeah. And it seems like where Juniper is now, companies probably know your reputation. So that if they're seeking you out, they probably like what you're offering and they want, you know, to pull that mission into what they're doing in their day-to-day stuff or their ad campaigns or whatever. So they obviously want that perspective and that team of people being like, this is what you need to do to send this message across in an authentic way. So,
yeah. And it's funny, we have never gotten a client from biz dev, marketing, budget, it's all been word of mouth. People find out who we are and what we've done or see our commercials or, you know, here we've worked with so-and-so and I'm so grateful. And I want that to continue. I guess selling ourselves is important, but I'd rather have it just, you know, proving the pudding and people see what we do and like it.
Yeah, definitely. So when you started out with Vice, you were doing their Vice Daily, right? Which is
Daily Vice. Yeah, it was a digital daily doc show. Yeah. It was sponsored by Verizon. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a team of, I think, six of us, and we were all, as it opened, I mean, I was so, the timing was like divine. Like the EP at that time came over from the Today Show.
Oh, nice.
But a lot of, I would say like half of them were people at Vice who were moved from other teams, then half of us were new. And it was so like playland. Like it was like, cool, what ideas do you guys have? What do you want to do? Like, what do you know? Like, so I never got to travel internationally, but other people on our team did. You know, I went to the Olympics and it was definitely a blend of like news and culture and subculture, really obviously, because that's what they do or did at the time. I think they've also changed a lot since I've left. But it was just an incredible experience.
Yeah, really incredible to just be there for the start of a show too. I mean, and just see how it worked, how all the nuts and bolts and how everything's built, I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I found a story about feral children, like famous feral children. I found one that was still alive and we went and talked to her about her experience of being found when she was like 5 or 6, I think, in the wilderness. And I don't know, that was like the most like social impact story, but I thought that was really interesting. I also did one on, there was a UK story about a dating, this is like the like more culture, less news, but it was a dating event in the UK where people got blindfolded and smelled each other's armpits and they had to choose their dates based on which smell they liked the best.
Wow.
So that happened. Yeah. The thing. But it was a great show and they covered a lot of really important issues too. We did a lot of really cool stuff on trans politicians. I interviewed the first trans member of Team USA, Chris Mosher, who's amazing. Yeah, he was incredible to work with. And it was just great. I learned so much on that job and anything, and that was awesome.
Cool. So what's the most challenging part of your job, Madeline?
Just that I'm responsible for literally everything.
Oh, that's all.
Yeah, I mean, like learning how to be a business leader is a daily process.
Yeah.
Some of it's just so not glamorous. You know, the thing I would say I loathe the most about my job is like I have like papers on my counter. This is, I didn't put these here for you, but these are just like from New York State, you know, the Department of Labor. Like, I don't like, please someone else do this. I don't want to do this. I have like an accounting guy, but there's just things that I need to figure out myself that are, you know, take time. And and sometimes I would say I've had some really hard calls with team members where like manning that line or womaning that line of like, when are you making a call because you care about somebody, you want them to feel fulfilled at work versus what's a business need.
Right.
And I let go of someone about a year ago who had truly become a really close friend and it just wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they felt shocked and betrayed because our friendship was close and because I worked really hard to empower them. And it was hard for me to know when am I giving clear enough warnings or when do I just need to make a call and say, you know what, we're going to pivot. It broke my heart. It really did. And also being youngish, I'm 38 and knowing that I'm not a pro at all of this. And sometimes my mistakes or my lessons are going to impact other people and owning that. So I think that's the hardest part.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's important for people to hear because, I mean, it's definitely a benefit being able to start your own business, being able to tell the stories you want to tell and help companies tell the stories in a really good way. So you're having a big social impact. But there's the flip side of owning your own business where you have to do the work that's not fun. You have to have tough conversations with the people that work for you. So, I mean, I think it's good for people to hear both sides of owning your own business.
Yeah.
So do you have a moment from your career, and this can be from any part of it, that's either a favorite moment or a moment where like, I can't believe this is what I get to do for a living?
It was my first job in Hollywood. I was a PA on the show that never made it to air called, Do You Trust Me? That's what it was called. Do You Trust Me? And it was like a prisoner's dilemma. I think it was like prisoner's dilemma. It was basically like two people coming together who don't know each other and they had to like work together to win money. And so it was like, do you trust me as we go together? But then there'd be like interjections. It's so awful. There'd be interjections in the show where a screen would drop down and you'd see a video about that person's like shady past that would make you maybe not trust them.
Wow.
And then you had to choose, right? Am I still going to trust you? And then, of course, if you steal the money and they steal the money, nobody gets the money.
Yeah, that's the prisoner's dilemma. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the prisoner's dilemma. Okay. So, anyway. And so it was my job to do whatever. I was like, gopher. But one of the guests, so sad, she was I'm not joking, a Buddhist monk from San Francisco. And she was a guest on the show and she got screwed over. The guy stole the money.
Mm.
And I had to drive her back to the airport.
Oh my God.
And she was so dejected. And I just felt for this woman. Like I just, you know, like, and I'm a very, for the most part, I think I'm very trusting and optimistic. Yeah. And so I was just heartbroken for her. And I was like, is there anything that I can do? You know, can we get you a coffee? And so I'm driving. She's like, no, but she's like, I'd never been to LA. And I'm just, maybe could we go see the Hollywood sign on the way to the airport? And so I like went to take her to the Hollywood sign and I'll never forget this like image of her getting out of the car. She like sat on the hood of my car and lit a joint and smoked a joint and just looked at the Hollywood sign. And I was just like, what is life? You know, like what is life? And it's not fair. And this like a strange Buddhist nun is smoking a joint on my car. And this is my life.
Wow.
That was definitely one of my favorite stories.
That game show sounds like a legal liability nightmare.
Yeah, this is probably why I didn't make it to air.
Just airing people's dirty laundry on national television.
Sounds like a lot. I mean,
it was fascinating. I was bummed.
Yeah, it would be really. I mean, I might watch it, but I could see why now could be like, I don't know if this is a good idea.
Yeah.
I do think it was, I remember thinking that it's just like, it's not great show to watch to like restore your faith in humanity.
No, definitely not.
Were pretty terrible. And that might have been, so it's not a feel good show. It's not. No.
Yeah. Cause I imagine a lot of people end up getting screwed over on it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Every episode ends with both people taking the money.
No.
Right. Exactly.
Well, we have one more question for you, Madeline, before we talk about the movie. What advice do you have for people who are interested in getting into either, you know, working at a production level or getting into the marketing world of the industry?
I mean, I started out my career really just throwing as much spaghetti on the wall as I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so important to like swing the F out and do not stop until you get somewhere that you're happy and find things to fuel you along the way. I mean, my desire and my dream is that people, no matter what they want to do, find some part of humanity that they care about. And how do you want to make the world a better place with that? But given that I can't control that, also know that karma is so real.
Mm-hmm.
So real. Sometimes it's instant. Sometimes it comes back years later, but like doing the right thing along the way, even if you don't win in the short term, is so important. This is from like a hiring perspective, because now I hire people is like, I think one of the things that's like the secret weapon that people don't realize carries you so far is enthusiasm. If I have two people who are equally talented, maybe even if one has a more impressive resume, but the other person's more enthusiastic, I will choose the enthusiastic person because I know that they are going to go above and beyond, that they're going to bring ideas to the table. I'm not going to have to pull for things.
Yeah.
That just counts for so much to be passionate and be willing to, oh my God, be willing to humiliate yourself all of the time. And the more you're willing to humiliate yourself, the less humiliating it feels, really, you know? I feel like I've just taken so many actions where I'm like, oh, I feel like an idiot, or I didn't, you know, look good in that or whatever. And like, wait, it's an emotion that passes and then you've done it and then you've done this thing.
Yeah.
So I'd say those two things, be willing to feel embarrassed and put yourself out there and be enthusiastic, have gotten me the farthest, I think.
Let's get to our featured film. Today we're discussing the 1992 film, A League of Their Own. It was written by Kim Wilson, Kelly Candili, Lowell Ganz, and Babalu Mandel. It was directed by Penny Marshall, and it stars Gina Davis, Tom Hanks, Lori Petty, Madonna, and Rosie O'Donnell. So Susan, can you give us a quick breakdown? What's this movie about?
Yeah, so this movie takes place during World War II. A lot of men are off fighting in the war. So former owner of the Cubs, or current owner of the Cubs at the time. He also owned a chocolate factory. He decided he wanted to create a women's baseball league because the men weren't there to play and they still wanted to keep baseball going. So he sends scouts, one of who is John Lovitz, out all over the country, and he recruits Dottie Hinson, her sister Kit, a few other people, May, who's played by Madonna, Doris, played by Rosie O'Donnell, women from all over the country, and forming a baseball team. So he brings them to Chicago, has tryouts, and then they get divided into four teams, one of which is the Rockford Peaches, which is the main team that's focused on in the movie. So we see this league develop. We see it kind of start to falter. We see it come back, see all the weird ways they make it famous and have it come back and be successful. And then, yeah, we just see the conflict within the team, too, and especially with these two sisters, Dottie and Kit, because there's a lot of conflict between the two of them that predates being in the baseball league, just being two sisters who have a little bit of a rivalry. And yeah, so that's kind of the setup. I think we'll get more into the plot as we talk about it.
But, totally.
Yeah.
Great. And then, Madeline, you chose this movie for us to watch. Why did you choose A League of Their Own?
I will tell you. I think this must have been the third or fourth movie I saw in the theaters that came out when I was in second grade.
Right.
And it's also probably the movie I've seen more than any other movie in my lifetime. I do not get sick of it. I just watched it today and engrossed, completely engrossed.
Yeah.
A couple of reasons why it's my favorite. I'm a big fan of historical fiction.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I really love when a movie, Forrest Gump also does a great job of this, weaves in like actual newsreels and actual footage from that time. I also think I was raised in a fairly feminist household, and I think the feminist values of this movie are so important. God bless Penny Marshall, who I don't know if you guys know, her daughter also was in this movie.
Oh, really?
Tracy Rainer is her.
I didn't know that was her daughter.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. I have a couple fun little
pepper them
facts for you guys throughout, because I'm that much of a dork when it comes to this film.
I love it.
You know, I love the empowerment angle. I love, there's a couple tropes that they speak on that are really important historically that are really moving to me. Tom Hanks in this film, like, just cannot get over him. Also, you mentioned John Lovitz, like everything that comes out of his mouth is gold. So there's a lot of reasons why I chose this film. Yeah, and it's had a massive impact on my life.
Yeah, we want to talk about all of those things, Madeline. But I mean, this movie is a classic for a reason. It is a delightful film, and I love the characters in it. I mean, every single one of the baseball players, even the ones who have like one line in the movie, they're all so distinct and they're all so different. And it's really great because the movie is based in, you know, this threat of war of a lot of them have husbands that are off fighting in the war. And so it's like a very serious backdrop, but then this movie's actually very funny. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of, you know, build off of that kind of like scary, and that the scene with the telegram is like the scariest scene, of course, right? Because somebody's husband has died and they all know it. And then that's the turning point for like Tom Hanks's character of Jimmy, right? Because it's like up to that point, he's just a jerk to everyone. He's yelling at everybody. He's drunk all the time. That's the first time he does something good, which is like where he doesn't make them wait to find out who it was. He just, you know, takes the telegram and reads it. And then you can slowly see him finally change. And it's funny because Tom Hanks was a huge star at the time this movie was made. He got top billing, but he doesn't show up until 30 minutes into the movie.
It's weird to think of him as a main character. I mean, he is a main character eventually, but...
Right. But he is doing classic Tom Hanks of just yelling a lot and like just being really shaky and weird, which he did a lot when he was younger. He does less of it now in movies. But that, like, I'm thinking of like classic Tom Hanks of like The Burbs and like old, like Big, you know, like those movies where he was very twitchy. He's since calmed down a little bit. But I love Gina Davis and I love Maury Patty. They are so good in this film.
Yeah, I agree. So it's interesting you're saying it's a funny movie, but when I watched it, I cried. I cried when Betty finds out her husband's died. It is it's heartbreaking. And I think you do fall in love with the characters. You find them so relatable. And I also think I literally wrote down like on note cards some of my favorite like story lines and how they evolve. And one of them is Tom Hanks and his kind of, I mean, literally, you know, historically speaking, they created this league at a time when no one was taking women seriously for anything.
Right. Right.
And I mean, I think that was honestly reflected when you see the fact that people aren't showing up for the games. And as you know, you mentioned, they kind of had to pull some tricks and really judge things up to get people to come. And just you see what women went through. You know, I loved when these girls are coming from all over the country to tryouts and then he brings out the uniforms they have to wear.
Right.
And Madonna's like, you know, well, we can't wear my husband's gonna think, you know, and they're just like, you don't play in this, you don't play at all.
Yeah.
You know, and the sexism that's just imbued throughout it.
Oh, yeah.
And even I took notes. So interesting, because even once Tom Hanks' character changes and you see that he really starts to invest in the women later in it was actually the beginning. Oh, actually it was the beginning of that scene when he's in the locker room and he says man on board or whatever. And he says something like, oh, too good you're dressed.
You're already. You know?
And I was just like, oh, you are such a dick.
Oh, he's still a jerk throughout the whole movie. I mean, he throws that baseball mitt at that kid at the end of the film.
Like...
also noted that. I love the woman Biddy who plays Evelyn. She was an incredible actor. I mean, just could not have done better casting. But there's so many things that are touched upon, the sexism, the also that, you know, it's like Gina Davis was such an interesting choice, and her character is both glamorous and beautiful and also like tough and like badass, you know. And I also think that speaks to these women who are like on the farm and like America is in strife. And I think they did a good job of like not having it be like, wasn't like Pleasantville where everyone's just like happy. Like people are dealing with real circumstances. Or you know, May talking about how she used to be a stripper and like she's gonna go back to that life when the league was threatening closing. And Rosie O'Donnell's character talking about the real judgment and discrimination she encountered because of she says, it's interesting, she says it's because I played baseball, but I think we also know it's talking about her femininity.
Right.
Yeah.
There's so many things that are so poignant. And this movie was made in 1992 and like these issues are still matter.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of like threading the real world in, there's that line where he's like, well, the men are coming home, so we won't need these women anymore. And it's like, you're just going to send them back to the kitchen. And it's like, well, you're going to send the men back to the kitchen. You know, in the real world, all these women were in factories, finally getting out of the house, you know, doing their own thing for so long.
Right.
And then it's like, oh, the war's over. And then they're like, oh, so we just go back. That was a huge conflict at the time in real life. Just dealing with like, we had a huge social change here while all the men were gone. And now you just expect us to go back to the status quo. Like, how do we do that?
Yeah. And they couldn't, you know, and so obviously in some ways they did, but it did change the future of how women related to themselves and their own agency. There was also another line. So I cry at that line time every time when she loses George. The other where I get full body chills is when they're at practice and someone throws a ball out of the field and a group of Black women are walking by. And that is I mean, I get chills just talking about that's a 10-second scene. And this woman picks up a ball, throws it to Gina Davis. There's no words exchanged. She just gives her a simple nod. And it's like this understanding. It's also the first time I think a lot of viewers in the show are realizing there's no Black people.
Right.
There's no Black people in this movie.
Right.
In the movie at all.
There's no Black people in the movie at all. And so I thought it was really important that they wove that in just to realize like the discrimination that like women weren't allowed to play. And I just got so moved because it's like you could tell this woman had talent. She had a strong arm.
Right.
You know, and also it just in the way that she looks at Jan Davis, it's almost like an understanding. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not allowed to be with you guys, but I'm with you, or something of that ilk of like, I see you as a woman and I kind of like, I back you from afar. Mm-hmm. That's the way that I interpreted it. I'm sure there's other interpretations, but yeah, I think that, you know, that was really poignant and a quick, you know, they could have honestly put more attention to that issue, but I thought it was pretty powerful. It was also 1992. So, you know, making excuses, but I understand, you know, the story.
Yeah,
absolutely. Most of the men in this movie are they're not villains, but they're not good guys. They're obviously part of, you know, they fall in the line of patriarchy.
Yeah.
Just the way that John Lovitz talks to them, the way that Tom Hanks talks to them, the owner. I think Ira, who's the, you know, sort of the league manager, is really the biggest advocate for women in the film outside of the women themselves. And it's interesting, you know, to look at those gender roles, because I always enjoy watching sports movies, but sometimes you can tell that the actors are not really doing it. But right. In this movie, they look like they're really, you know, they are sliding the bases. They are hitting the balls. These actors look like they can really play. And I think that really adds to how much fun this movie is to watch.
Totally. Ken Sells was the inspiration for that character. And I think that's really interesting that a lot of these people were based.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were based on that.
I mean, I love the relationship between Dottie and Kit.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think that's really the heart of the movie, mm-hmm. is that these, you know, these two sisters who, I mean, the older sister, to your point, Madeline, who's, you know, who's beautiful, who's good at, you know, she's obviously the star of the team, right? And, you know, who's going out of her way to really attract fans by doing all these crazy stunts and stuff. But how jealous Kit gets, and, you know, that competition in their relationship. And also that Dottie's like, I'm not even trying to, you know, like, hold it against you. But Kit obviously sees it that way, right? And then obviously the finale of the two teams going up against each other is just great. It's just really good filmmaking. And my question, though, to both of you is, do you think Dottie drops the ball on purpose at the end?
It is such a good question. I, for the longest time, thought she did drop it on purpose. When I watched it today, I actually think they did such a good job that it's really hard to tell.
It is not clear.
There's a little bit of, like, you think she did because you see how happy she was as she can't win and all of that. I think they make it really amorphous for that reason. I think it's hard to call.
Yeah, I agree. I have no idea. I could go either way. A reason for why she didn't is I don't know that she would sacrifice the whole team for one thing, even though it is her sister, just because she seems like she's all on board with the team.
And I think she did it on purpose.
You think so?
Yeah. I think, you know, because the look she gives right before, as she sees her, like, rounded face coming into home, and then just, you know, to your point, how happy she is afterwards, I think she dropped it on purpose.
Yeah.
I also think she was too good.
Exactly.
Mistake like that.
Exactly. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. The other part of this movie that I think really made it is, you know, Hans Zimmer did the music on it.
Yeah.
And he's obviously incredible. And they don't play this song during the movie, but they do in the credits, "This Used to Be My Playground," which is by Madonna.
Right.
The ultimate nostalgia. Like, that used to be my playground too. Yeah. Like, you just fall. You're like, yes. Like, yes, I'm going to go cry in my pillow when you tell me about things that used to be good.
Yeah. That song is heart-wrenching. I think it won a Golden Globe, or it was at least nominated. But yeah, a really good, powerful way to end the movie, because it ends on them going to the Baseball Hall of Fame, right? And seeing themselves in this exhibit and reliving their history. And then to also have to relive those feelings of, like, this was like the, you know, that kid, the kid came back and was like, my mom said this was the best time of her life, was these years.
Yeah. Solo Angel.
It's bittersweet. And that song captured it perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah. I also thought, like, just the, you know, they scan up on Jimmy Dugan's photo and then just go down to, like, and that's how they let you know that he wasn't there. He's gone, you know, and interesting fact about the older version of Gina Davis, and maybe you could tell, but it was a voiceover. So that's Gina Davis's voice over that actress's. Yeah. That's like how they, like, then they didn't do that with any of the other women, but Gina Davis's voice was the old woman.
They did a great job casting those older women.
Oh my God. Incredible.
They definitely did. It was kind of weird, though, because a lot of the women that the actors playing the baseball players, like Rosie O'Donnell and all them, are the age of those women now. Right. So it was kind of weird to be like, that's not what she looks like.
That's true.
But no, they did a great job casting. That's not a real critique.
Madonna definitely doesn't look like that. Let's
speak. No, she does not look like that.
Can we talk about some of our favorite quotes in the movie or lines?
Please.
Yeah.
Please.
So obviously the most famous one is, there's no crying in baseball. We all know that.
Yep.
My all-time favorite, and just like Jimmy Dugan doesn't appear until 30 minutes in, John Lovitz is only in for like the first 15. Yeah.
And then he's gone.
The star of the show. He's so good. I think everything that he says is hilarious. And my favorite line in the movie is when, you know, we also could talk about Marla Hooch and, like, Pretty Privilege. Yes. And I love the fact that Dottie and Kit would not go unless Marla was in. Because I think it's unfair for her to be discriminated against from her appearance, which is like, hell yeah. Like, that good. And that also makes you love both of them, yes. You know?
Right, right.
Especially Dottie, because she is the glamorous one. And I think there is a stigma around women who are beautiful. And one thing, the relationship that's created and solidified and shown in like a minute between Marla and her father, yes, also brings me to tears.
Yes.
And like how he says, like, you know, her mom died, I had to raise her, don't punish me because I didn't know how to raise her like a girl.
Right.
And then you see that bond with them at the station. She doesn't want to go. I just like,
yeah.
Oh, it gets me every time. But then when she's standing there and John Lovitz looks at her and says, how it works is the train moves, yeah, not the station. It's just like, oh my God, I love him so much. That writing of his character was so brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Do you guys have a favorite scene from the film?
The first one that comes to mind, this is not my favorite, but it is one of my favorites, is when Dottie leaves because her husband comes back and then she sneaks back into the game, yeah, and Tom Hanks is yelling at her.
Yeah.
And doesn't know that it's her. And then he's like, she pulls off, she's stop yelling at me. And he's like, well, who says you can play? And this, like, yeah, that exchange of just like, you know, and then she's like, you look like shit, you should shave. Like that like really encompasses, yes, the whole, yeah, dynamic. And he's like, we're going to win, you know? I think that scene is, it's not like poignant or like the deepest, but it's just, right, such a beautiful reflection of their relationship and, yeah, their totally bond. And how they kind of feel like partners, well, in this. Yeah. They're not coach and player relationship.
I also love that they don't fall in love. You know, yeah, like that's not, yeah, a relationship. Yeah. I love that.
Totally. It's a buddy-buddy relationship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you guys? I'm trying to think of a second one.
There's a lot of good scenes. One scene I like just for the action and editing of it, the tryout scenes, yeah, where they're just constantly cutting between all the moves they're doing. I, yep, think it was really fun to watch and just a really good action scene for the movie. What else? There's a lot of good ones. One that, so a good contrast of scenes, Marla talking to her dad when they first established the relationship and him being so supportive of her going and being like, she needs to go. She's so good.
Yeah.
She has to go do this. Versus, I forgot the player's name, but her husband doesn't want to take care of their son while she's on the road anymore.
Evelyn.
So like, yeah, yep, Evelyn. Yes. So she's like, can I bring him with me? Just such a contrast of like women's families supporting them, right, or not supporting them, I think was illustrated, yeah, really well, totally, with those two scenes.
Oh my God, that kid though.
That kid.
Seriously, who didn't want to hit him with a
right,
yeah, at the end? Oh my God.
The Suds Bucket Roadhouse scene.
Yes. Yes. Oh, the so swing fun dancing, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So fun. And so because a lot of the scenes, action scenes are baseball. So to see this like cultural scene, yeah, and then, right, Marla on stage falling in love with, yeah, this guy. That scene where Dottie's trying to get them out and she says, where's Marla? And they all get really quiet and they're like, she's still here.
Yeah.
Like, where? She's like, right there. You know, and you see Gina look and she's like, what happened? That's amazing because you also see a whole evolution of Marla's,
yes,
character. And you also, totally, see, I love the sisterhood that is yes, brewed through this entire movie. And you see that in a new way socially, not just on the field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A really funny sequence leading up to that, and a very insane sequence, is when they're sneaking out to go to the roadhouse and May's like, yeah, I'm just gonna poison her dinner. And then you see her like throwing up and like, a woman's never thrown up this much, she shouldn't wear these shoes. And then they're walking through in the background. I'm like, this is bonkers.
It's totally bonkers because they're like, they say that is their plan, but you don't think they're actually gonna do, yeah, it. And then they cut to that. They cut past it and they're like, oh, we already poisoned her. Yeah. It's like, what?
I mean, May throughout the entire movie, when she makes the priest drop the Bible, yes, a bunch of times, yeah, during confession, yeah, the way she makes eyes at Ira.
I mean, honestly, Madonna kills this
movie. All her,
oh my God.
Yeah, all her interactions with the reporters, really, yeah, great. And still she's being so supportive. Like, she obviously wants to be the center of attention, but she's still like pulling Rosie O'Donnell's, you know, pouring Doris in and being like, Doris, yeah, for the team. Like,
she's,
yeah,
for the team.
Yeah. Yeah,
so awesome. There's also that time where she's like trying to think about ways to get, she's like, what if, you know, just by happenstance, my uniform comes undone, right, and my bosoms happen to fly out. And then Doris is like, do you think there's a guy who hasn't seen your boobs? You know, like, such a good wrap to that.
Yeah. Such a good, yeah. The lines are very, yeah, really good.
Really great writing.
We'd like to finish up our show today with a game that we're calling A League of Their Own Owns. In honor of our film today, we're going to see how well both of you know films from the cast of The League of Their Own. So Madeline and Susan, you'll be playing as a team. So here are the rules. I've given both of you a list of films. You will take turns describing the film's characters, plot, actors to each other as quickly as you can, whatever you want, but you cannot use the name of the movie. You will have 1 minute to get your partner to guess as many as possible. And if you get 5 correct, then Madeline will win our prize. And Susan, what's our prize?
Life in the Credits merchandise, like a mug or a shirt, tote bag, something like that.
Yeah, we'll send you something in the mail. All right. So, Madeline, are you ready to play?
Yeah.
And so you can start whenever you're ready.
Okay. This movie is a little boy who falls in love with a killer killer whale.
Free Willy?
Yes, 1 point.
All right. This is a Madonna movie. It might have been our first movie. It's revolved around personal ads. This woman's like very frustrated with her husband. So she answers a personal ad.
Is that Cover Girl? No.
An 80s movie. Get Into the Groove is the song in it, if that helps.
Pass.
This is a little part. All right. This movie is a parody of a movie about a man who steals from the rich to give to the poor. He hangs out with Little John in the woods.
Like Robin Hood, Men in Tights?
Yep. Yes. 2 points.
Okay. Oh, this is about a young boy who grows up in Greenbow, Alabama, and Sally Field.
3 points.
This movie is about a guy who performs at people's nuptial celebrations.
Wedding singer.
Yeah. Yes. 4 points.
This is a movie with Tom Hanks, who lives in the Pacific Northwest, who is widowed and falls in love with Meg Ryan in New York City.
Oh, Sleepless in Seattle?
Yes, and that's 1 minute.
Oh, okay. We got to be a five.
You got exactly okay. five.
Oh, God.
Wow, that was
close. That one was Desperately Seeking Susan, which is like a little bit before our time. So
good job, guys. That was amazing.
Yeah.
You barely won, but is a win. So well done.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Madeline. Before we let you go, is there anything that you would like to plug?
Love us. Love Juniper. Give us all your love. Come to our website. Check out our work. Yeah, like if people want to work with us or have ideas or they want to send us our client, I mean, like, yeah, we want to grow. We really do want to create real change through this. This is not about the clients. It's about the change. So just be our friend.
Yeah. Awesome.
Our friends. Well, thank you for joining us today, Madeline. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, this was great.
Yeah, so much fun.
Life in the Credits is hosted and produced by me, Susan Swarner.
And me, Ben Bloom.
It's executive produced by Michelle Levin.
The music is written and performed by Steve Trowbridge. You can hear more of Steve's music at TrowbridgeSongs.com.
The show logo is created by Melissa Durkin.
If you'd like to support Life in the Credits and get access to exclusive perks, you can do so at Patreon.com.
If you'd like to follow or get a hold of us, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Life in the Credits or shoot us an email at lifeinthecredits@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Ben is tricky sometimes with these games.
Ben is tricky. that's just true.